to 6 Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes. 6 Music. Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new episode of The First Time here on BBC 6 Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is a multi-instrumentalist, producer, soundtrack composer, electronic and analog artist, someone who stages dynamic live performances and studio masterpieces, as comfortable capturing the spontaneous as she is the meticulous, but whose work is always about investigating new territory. She's Mercury nominated and an Ivor Novello winner, and one of the UK's most innovative musical voices. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time, Hannah Peel. You just heard the title track from Hannah's brand new score for the film Midwinter Break, which has just landed. In this conversation, we discuss Hannah's early and very family-focused musical influences growing up in Northern Ireland, studying at the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, and the story behind her first release, the 2009 EP Rebox, a beautiful collection of cover versions. We also cover some of her most creative collaborations with Paul Weller, John Fox, and most recently, the Para Orchestra, with whom she did the recent album The Unfolding. And we talk Ivor Novello's Game of Thrones and the joys of Boards of Canada, Aphex Twin and Joni Mitchell. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music as a child?
I had one of those in the 80s, those Playfisher tapes machines.
Yeah.
That had a massive handle. They were like kind of creamy beige and they had big brown buttons that were like stop, play, fast forward, rewind. And then you just put the tape in and that was it. And I remember carrying it everywhere. And I had one tape. There was one piece on the tape that was more instrumental and I loved it, but the others that were on it were like Puff the Magic Dragon.
Banger.
And, and that one where I saw a mouse. Where?
They're on the stair. Yep.
Yeah.
Where on the stair, right there, a little mouse with clogs on. Well, I declare, going clip-clippity-clop on the stair. Oh, yeah.
So those were definitely on it, but I just recall like being put into a shopping trolley, you know, in the little seats, and having my tape player and being really upset about the fact that I had to turn it off to go into the supermarket. And that's a really clear, vivid memory of me playing and rewinding and playing and rewinding this thing over and over again. So that was definitely the first time I was aware of music and what it was.
But that was a really strong connection straight away. Like some kids would have a favourite toy, your toy was a musical thing. Yeah. And a musical thing that you could control as well.
Yeah, there's a picture that my brother found in a photo album and it's me sat on the toilet with my tape player. So yeah, that was the average day, I think. I guess it's definitely informed where I've gone, and I would have been about 3 or 4.
Wow. So. Was it quite a musical household that you grew up in?
Yeah, in a way, my dad plays the guitar and sings and does a lot of folk music. My mum was a school teacher, so she wasn't that musical, but she would bring home tapes from the school lessons. They got like educational magazines and then they'd get a tape on the front of it. And one in particular was Holst's The Planets. And every kind of planet had a drawing that went with the tune. So I would always sit with the tape and listen and then look at the pictures. And my grandparents on my mum's side had a piano in their house, which they would have hymn music. This is in Northern Ireland. They would have had hymn music. But there was one book in particular that had very colourful images of maybe like a girl with a basket and things. And so I couldn't read music, but I would sit at the piano and play for the images. And one of those pieces as well in one of the books was Walking, I'm Walking on the Air.
Yeah.
From The Snowman. And I remember trying to learn this piece and I think they'd taught me like a melody line and I just played it. And then I played it over and over and over again to the point where my uncle at Christmas was like, will you stop playing that damn piano? But on my dad's side, they were very musical. So my grandfather was a choir boy when he was young.
Yeah.
And he studied at Chetham's in Manchester and then moved to Northern Ireland where he met my grandmother. And so he taught music and conducted and played the organ in the cathedral as well in Northern Ireland. So that side was very musical in terms of like everybody was in a choir or singing all the time. So there was always something.
And it was a familial thing as well. It was like your father, your family. This was about the family community as well as just enjoying music. It was a connector.
Yeah, absolutely. And with no kind of pressure at all. It was just there. It was just part of who we were and what we did. And, you know, a lot of my dad's songs would have been like Johnny Cash or Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree. That was one of his songs and still is, sorry. And so I remember, like, in particular, he would come home from work and on this one day, a very sunny day, there was two trees in our back garden and I'd tied all my yellow ribbons around the tree. And he was so stressed with work, he literally went, "Hi, Hannah," and walked past me. And I was like, stood there going, all my artwork.
Oh, God.
And he didn't notice. So I had to run in and like say, "Oh, Dad, come outside and see what I've done." And then he realised. But yeah, he was just in one mind of like, get home from work, cook the dinner kind of thing.
Now the whole damn bus is cheering and I can't believe I see 100 yellow ribbons around the
Yeah, it was always there, always in life.
And was piano the first kind of instrument that you got competent or you found you could express yourself on?
Yeah, that was certainly the first. And then when we moved from Northern Ireland to Barnsley, there was an amazing performing arts service there that was opposite the football pitch. And they did free brass lessons, string lessons, and you could get an instrument either for free or very, very cheap,
you know,
maybe £5 a year or something rent. I've started on the cornet and joined the local brass band and then joined the orchestra and then learnt the violin. So every night there was always something to go to, and that was in primary school. And then went on to do the same in the secondary school, which was really good for music. It was just a lot of music, a lot of bands, a lot of people playing together. And it was, just one of those things that you just did with your friends. You don't think about what you're going to do in the future. You just do it because that's your way of communicating. And I guess moving from countries is always hard in itself. So finding something that you can relate to all the time, I think it was a very clever move of my parents. Maybe they didn't realise, or they just did it subconsciously. I'm pretty sure, in fact, my mum, because she was working late, she didn't know what to do with us after school because she couldn't come home early. So
give her a corner.
pretty sure a lot of it was extracurricular to eat up our time.
So what was the first record or tape or CD or whatever that you went to go and buy for you? Because there's that thing, isn't it, when you hit your very early teens or whatever, you start thinking, well, this is, there's all this other stuff and that's fine, but what's my music? What's the stuff that's coming out that's for me?
We had a neighbour next door called Mr. Bucock, which is a wonderful name, and he was massively into vinyl, had a lot and very precious about it, as people are with their vinyl. They wouldn't let you necessarily touch it.
Don't even look at it.
Especially a child. And he gave me a vinyl of the Carpenters, like Greatest Hits, and said that I could have it for a day or two as long as I looked after it and listened to it. So I put it on, and the first track that I remember hearing where you get that feeling of like shivers up your spine and you go, oh my God, is Karen Carpenter singing "Why Do Birds
Suddenly Appear Every Time You Are Near?" Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be close to you.
And My mum was cooking like a Sunday roast. I could remember the smells. The sunlight was coming through the window and I just had this feeling of like, oh, that's music and that's what a vocalist sounds like. And I had to give it back to him. So the first record I ever bought was one of theirs, just to hear her voice again. And then when I hit my teens, looking for kind of inspiration with red hair, women, I went for Tori Amos, and Under the Pink, I think, was the first one. And that stayed with me for years until I got to see her in concert and thought she was just magnetic on stage. And
yeah.
I think we talk about how incredible she was and still is. But yeah, back then it was just like mind blowing what she could do, you know, two pianos at once. And I'd never seen anything like that and didn't know you could even do that kind of thing. So
yeah,
it changed a lot.
What Tori track should we play at this point then?
Conflict Girl. Obviously.
Never was a cornflake girl. Thought that was a good solution, hanging with the raisin girls. She's gone to the other side, giving us a yo-yo. Things are getting kind of gross, and I go at sleepy time. This is not really this. This is not really happening. You bet your life it is. You bet your life it is. Honey, you bet your life. It's a peel out the watchword. Just peel out the watchword.
Another big first, kind of maybe aside from your family doing kind of performances, what was the first gig or concert that made a real impression? Because it's different when you see people performing live. Records are awesome, but seeing that thing unfolding on stage when there wasn't anything before is always, it's still magical.
We went to a lot of concerts, a lot of Irish, you know, we went to the Corrs. I saw even Ocean Colour Scene. They're not Irish, but you know what I mean? They played a massive part in my teenage life. But I think the one thing that really changed the way I think about music was my first year of being a student in Liverpool. I went to Manchester to the Bridgewater Hall to see Cinematic Orchestra.
Right.
And they were playing to a silent film, like a 1930s Dada silent film called Man with a Movie Camera. And I just couldn't get over how the live sense of music and the visuals work together. I was just blown away because I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen live music with film. I was always interested in film and liked visuals and stories, but I just had never seen that work like that before. Like, you know, the same kind of shivers as the Karen Carpenter song. So that certainly change things in terms of instrumental music and where I would then go from my 20s onwards.
Yeah. Were you a good student?
Yes, I was very good, Matt.
But you know, but like so. Some people who are enormously adept at their subject, whatever it is, the constraints of a conventional education aren't always for them. Other people find it the most hugely valuable grounding in what they do, and other people just can't stand it. I don't know. How is it for you?
Bit of both. I would say, yeah, I was a good student. I did what I was told and I did what I needed to do. And it's the same with exercise. If I don't have somebody telling me what to do, I kind of like, don't do it. So having peers around and really amazing lecturers was really great. I went to a place called Lipper in Liverpool, which is the Paul McCartney kind of place. And it was just brilliant to be in with people who just want to jam and make music and be free with what they make and not necessarily have to read. And I came from a really kind of graded background in classical where I had to do all these certain things. And I'd gone to do classical music and I didn't like it. I'd gone to do acting and I didn't like it. And then eventually I ended up doing a performing arts music degree. But yeah, I mean, I did well. I did really well. But there was certain times that I felt like I was doing everything against the norm. I wrote a score for silent film inspired by cinematic orchestra, and we even took it to a festival, and I can't remember the name of it. It was a massive festival in England at the time. We did it really well. It was at the Blue Coats Art Centre. It was like, I went to London to the BFI to like research the films as well and watch them on the reels, and did this amazing show. And then the head of the university at the time said to me, yes, it's not my cup of tea. And I was like, I just don't care. I don't care that it's not the normal thing, and I'm not doing a musical, or I'm not doing anything that's required of this. This is what I want to do. So see you later.
So was that your first kind of paid professional job as a musician then?
Yeah, like did it at uni, and then whilst there took it on tour, made it into a DVD and sent it to loads of promoters. I didn't have a clue. I just was like, I want to do it here, and that's it. And I think it went to the Manchester Film Festival as well, and a couple of places. I mean, this is a long time ago, so I can't remember, but it was the first time I'd had a budget. I'd managed musicians, I'd played and wrote something and tried to market it in whatever way I could. I did that for a while, and that was instrumental music. But at the same time, my paid job then was to be a session musician for a lot of bands, and either record or go on tour or teach singing as well. I did that in Liverpool for a long time. So I was juggling a lot of different things, but mostly, yeah, it would have been playing gigs and live work.
Another big first. What was your first release?
I don't remember.
Would it have been the Reebok CP? Would that have been the very first thing that came out? That was 2009?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my first release. Thanks, Matt.
Because it's this beautiful collection of kind of sort of reinterpretations, sort of cover versions of songs. How did that come about? Because I listened to it before, and it's got a really lovely fragility to it. It's beautiful, beautiful collection of tracks. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of theatre shows, writing music for theatre and things in Liverpool, and one particular occasion needed things that spun round or were circular, had motion. And I just did some research and found this music box on a magic shop, would you believe? And it was programmable, and I was like, oh, fantastic. I can like punch all the holes, I can make this music and play it live.
With like bits of paper, like old programming sheets?
Proper analogue, and I joined them together with bits of sellotape to make them longer, because they're only like 50 centimetres kind of length, and you need a lot of them to make it work. And when it was finished, that show, I was like, oh gosh, I think there was a Jose Gonzalez cover at the time. He'd done a cover of an 80s song, and he was quite big at that point. And I was like, oh, I wonder what it'd sound like if I did an 80s cover. And I thought, oh, I'll do Tainted Love. I love Tainted Love.
Sometimes I feel I've got to run away. I've got to get away from the pain that you drive into the heart of me. The love we share seems to go nowhere, and I've lost my light, for I toss and turn, I can't sleep at night. Once I ran to you, now I'll run from you. This tainted love you've given, I give you all a girl could give you. Take my tears, and that's not many. Oh, tainted love.
And then just from playing those couple of bars and going, oh, this works really well. And it, I think my thing was, I didn't want it to be twee and folky and be in that kind of singer-songwriter world at that time. So I was like, oh, I'll just carry on. And it just worked really well. And I just had it, this little silver kind of metal box. And I didn't have anything like a sound generator with it, like anything for it to resonate against. So I had it on a tiny kind of little African drum, and had a contact mic stuck to that, and recorded it in my bedroom and made this EP. And actually, Andy McCluskey from OMD ended up singing on one of them, because he was in Liverpool, obviously. And I was like, sent it to him, and he said, oh, I'll sing on this for you if you give me some more samples of your other stuff. So we did an exchange. And then I was on tour with a wonderful band called the Unthanks, Northumbrian folk.
Amazing people.
I was doing violin and trombone and singing for them at the time. And I got this call from a guy called Jeff, who runs a label called Static Caravan down in Birmingham. And he was like, I've got this EP of yours. I'd sent it to maybe a couple of people that I know of. It hadn't sent it to him. He'd been past it. And he was like, I want to put it out in vinyl. And I had to go to the toilet in the venue to talk about this because I was like, I can't let anybody hear me. You know, it's so unprofessional. I'm talking about
sitting in the loo instead.
Yeah. And he was like, I'll put it on a vinyl. And I was like, who the hell's going to buy that? No one's going to buy that. He was like, look, just let me do it. I think it went out. It was like a run of 500. And it just sold out straight away. And then he was like, look, I'll put you in the studio with a producer, this guy Mike Lindsay in Shoreditch, and see how it goes. We'll do another EP of your own original stuff. And I was like, oh, brilliant. So we tried it out and it worked really well. And we didn't do the EP, we did an album.
Temperance, the dear old dear, did not dare to bother anyone's ear. With her uptight jaw, her hair tightly pinned, who'd have thought the sin to be within? Oh, bury me under the almond tree. If anything should happen to me,
Broken Wave in 2010, which is like something about First Records as well. Going back to what you're saying about your parents and music, the expectation isn't there. It's let's just make something, let's just play, let's not worry about it being formally recognised, let's just do an EP. Oh, I should make an album. And it felt like that. Can you remember people's reaction when it first came out?
Yeah, I do. I wasn't happy.
Why weren't you happy?
Do you know, I never was quite satisfied with my sound. And Mike was the most incredible producer, and he took that very playfulness that I have and put it into this kind of folktronica kind of world. And it felt really connected at the time and everything, but I still didn't feel like it was me. And so when I got reviews that were like, this is a folk record and she's another folk singer, and it really, really pissed me off. And I was like, I'm never doing this again. Like, I didn't want to have that on me where somebody judges you. I didn't know about things in the record industry. I don't know how you get genred or put in a box or anything. So I was like, how dare they talk about this record in that way? Because it's quite clearly there are, oh yes, they are some covers of some Irish traditional songs on there. So maybe you would say it was folk, but it was done in a way that wasn't. And it wasn't trad. And I think, you know, when you're young, you just want to step away from where you've been and grown up, don't you, and push forward, and you don't want to be like your parents, or you don't want to be known. And naturally you're gonna on your first record because that's all your influences of where you've been. So yeah, but during that record, and this is what I love about music, is you can be in a certain place and then somebody walks past the door and it changes everything. And in that studio, next door was a producer called Benj, amazing electronic artist, and he works with like John Grant and Cabaret Voltaire at the moment and things like that. And he was working with John Fox of Ultravox fame. And John, this beautifully well-dressed gentleman, kept walking through the back of our studio whilst I was making this music to go into the kitchen, and that was the only route through. And so he would pop in and say hello and then listen to the music and then off he'd go. And once I'd finished recording that record that they were making in the studio, it was under the name John Fox and the Maths. Mm-hmm. His manager got in touch, Steve, and said, we're looking for a violinist and a synthesist. Would you be interested in joining the live band? And I was like, all right, that sounds really cool. Yeah, certainly. And so we put, you know, I ended up meeting John. I ended up learning very quickly how to use analog synths and stepped into that world. And as soon as that happened, I was like, okay, this is my world. This is where I feel comfortable. This is what I love. And that just set off a whole world then.
She was dressed in a white suit. She looked like a bride, too. It's a burning car. It's a burning car. Then I looked at the sun set. And it felt like sage set. It's a burning car. It's a burning car. All right.
I was going to ask, I mean, this is it. Do you ask about the first kind of synth electronic record you get into, or do you ask you to geek off about the first bit of analog gear that you owned?
Yeah, first analog gear.
Go on then. What was it?
I bought a Juno 60, a Roland Juno 60, and I still have it. It's just over here.
With the wooden sides? Brilliant. That's what you
yeah.
want.
Yeah. It was on nearly every single record after that. It was on Awake But Always Dreaming, and it was on Mary Cassio, quite heavily featured on that as well. But that was the first thing I bought, and then I've just grown from there in terms of adding more and more and more. But I don't know why it was that one. Maybe I was using one similar and Bench had said, why don't you get this? And I don't even remember where I got it from. But no matter. And, you know, I learned in that period of, like, because we were playing John's Metamatic record, which Ben and Carr and Underpass are on, and it was a real seminal record. We were redoing the synths. So we were using the original synths, and I had to learn how to program really, really fast and also play the violin through loads of pedals and sing at the same time. And it was like a full, like, immersion. And we rehearsed for a couple of weeks and then took it on the road. And it just, I think when you're with analog synths as well and you know the nuances, you know that they can go wrong at every minute, you quickly learn what to do next and how to make a sound, or if a patch has gone missing or something has gone wrong, like, how do you fix that? And I think that challenge has always been the most interesting thing of, like, all right, what's next? It keeps you on a bit of a high on like what can happen. Anything could go wrong at any point.
Yeah, because we've talked about this when we've spoken before about this idea that just because something is synthesized doesn't mean it's not human. That's the whole point of it, whether you're Kraftwerk or Aphex Twin. There's a humanity in those records that's got nothing to do with the fact that it's an electronic sine wave that's been turned into something else. One of the most important things to you is trying to illustrate that the best possible way, I guess.
I find them really emotional. I think there's such a power of what they can do, and combining that with live instrumentation or acoustic instrumentation is really something else. Like, it should be treated in the same world. And for me, it's always added something else to it. I guess it makes the music more ethereal, or you would say it's more sci-fi, but it's always got a human connection. And I think that's really important about playing them and being able to use them. I've got a couple of modular synths. I'm not the best at it, and I'll admit that. You know, some people can have walls of synthesizers and know exactly what to do with them. I ain't got time for that. but I appreciate how incredible it is to sit and program that and play that live as well. And so in my way, I do it with the synthesizers and sounds and things.
So kind of following that, because obviously this is about music that you love as well. Like, should we talk about Buzz of Canada? That's an artist that you've talked about as being influential and kind of important to you. When did you first experience them?
Ooh, I mean, it must have been when I was at university.
Right.
That record, the one with the children on the front, it was that and Aphex Twin at that time. He'd done his piano, like the prepared piano pieces.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, this is just insane, like two different worlds. Like, they just open up your mind in different ways. And the technicality behind them is actually really interesting. And that's one of the things that I really love about Buzz of Canada. That it, you know, it's minimal music, it moves, but it still moves. It still has so many different textures and layers to it. And every time you listen to it, you hear something else. And I think that's really wonderful about that style of music, was that it showed you that a piece of music could have nostalgia and memory as well as being forward thinking.
What should we play? What would be soundtracking a smoky CD player in a student dorm room?
Olsen. So Music Has the Right to Children, and then the track is called Olsen.
Another big first. What was the first film score you did?
That I did or I heard?
That you actually, okay, here you go. First one that made a real impression on you, and then the first one that you did as a professional.
As a professional musician.
Oh, wow, yeah. So there was a film called Hable con Ella, and the soundtrack was by Alberto Iglesias. And I think it was the first soundtrack that I heard where I just wanted to play it as a soundtrack over and over again. I think there was like a few things as I was growing up, like Romeo and Juliet and the soundtrack to that and all these incredible songs, and you just have it as a record.
Yeah.
And it was a real thing at the time where you got the soundtrack to a film but full of songs. And it doesn't seem to happen that much anymore where they're like actually quite cool songs. But Hable con Ella was one of the first where I heard it, and it's a Spanish soundtrack. It is like acoustic Spanish guitar, beautiful strings, gorgeous voice. And it was just playing one night when we were all having like a bit of a dinner, and I just thought it was just the most amazing soundtrack. So yeah, that played on my mind for a long, long time in terms of like influence. And not that I've ever written anything like it, but just, I think, you know, just something that sparks a different world.
Yeah.
And lets your mind dream of things.
Yeah.
And play. I think it was one of those ones.
But what about your first commission in the film work? Because that's a very different set of skills and disciplines to take on board if you're supplying music for someone else's vision. Yeah. And from the composers I know, it can sometimes prove as challenging as it is rewarding. But What was your first experience of that?
I have to say it was amazing. It was so good. I think the reason I got into doing any solo music was in order to kind of have this side where I could score. And I wasn't coming at it from a film scoring point of view, like I hadn't been film trained or anything like that. In fact, I'd even applied for a master's to do film scoring, and it was at the Royal College of Music, and I was rejected because they said I didn't have the classical training to do it.
How dare they?
I know. And I think it was just a bit of bias because I'd been to a pop college. I hadn't been to a trained college. But on that interview panel was a younger composer, and he rang me afterwards and said, you know, you've not got through to the masters, but your sound is really good. Please just keep developing your own music and you'll get there eventually. And so that's what I did. I just was like, right, well, I'll just make records and I'll keep making records. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then I'd been in a band called The Magnetic North, and a director, a documentary director called Jeannie Finley, had placed one of our tracks at the very end of her film about the great hip-hop hoax, about the guys that are the rappers from Scotland but pretended to be American. And then they got a massive deal, and then it all got revealed that they weren't American at all. They were Scottish.
It's a really good story.
But the film is brilliant. And so I'd met Jeannie at that. And a couple of years later, she phoned and she said, I'm doing another film. I know your connections with Northern Ireland. And this is a behind the scenes film about the whole of Game of Thrones. It's based around the whole of the last season, but it's all about the creators, the makers, those who have dedicated 10 years of their lives to this and the impact it's had on families and where they live and how they work. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to do it. So that was in 2017, 2018. And that was my first official film score. Went really well, and I got nominated for an Emmy Award for it, and we went to LA, and it was just a brilliant starter. It kicked off a lot of things, and it kicked off me learning a whole new skill, something that I always wanted to do. But, you know, making records and scoring for film and TV is very, very different, and you have to bring in different skill sets and have a different mind. Like, your ego has to disappear. Yeah, so it was that film. I can't believe it was Game of Thrones that did it.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Another first, I have to ask you about first meeting Paul Weller, but I want to ask why you and Paul do you think work? Because it's been a returning creative relationship. It's not like a one-off thing. It's something that could have happened again and again. What is it about, do you think, the way that he works and what he wants to do that means that he's asked you back time and time again?
Do you know, Paul has a side to him that is very experimental, and he is always open to new ideas and doing new things and approaching new songs. And even when he's on tour, he's playing new records. Like, he does not look back. He just keeps moving forward. And I guess because I was quite young when I first met him, in terms of like going in and scoring something for him, and it's just gone from there. It's just developed, and it's just really, I mean, I still don't take it for granted that I get asked every time. I mean, I don't score strings and brass for that many people. I tend to not have the time, but I will do it for Paul because I love the way he sings. For me, he's always got a real old romantic side to him that I think is really important. Like, he loves melody. And so every time I do anything for him orchestration wise, it is always full of melody and it's always full of kind of story arcs, and it follows what his vocal is doing, and I just find it super interesting. So I'm always going to do it no matter what, and even if I haven't got time, I'm always like, I will make time to work with you. And he's just so lovely to work with. He's very gentle and caring and just a lovely person, so it's a real joy.
I know that Joni Mitchell is someone that's had an impact on you. When did you first hear Joni, and what is it about her music? It's a ridiculous thing to say, isn't it? Let's be honest, because she's Joni Mitchell. But
yeah,
how does her work tie in with what you try to achieve with yours?
I think it's her openness, playfulness. Or the first album, actually, that I fell in love with, and it's still one of my favourite records. In fact, I play it if I'm doing a show. I will play it before I go on just to sing along to it, and it's Caught and Spark. And I think the way she approaches music, the way the instrumentation changes and develops, the way that her songs work so in sync with the chords and the melodies, like the way the lyrics work. I am not a lyricist. I admire songwriters massively because I find lyrics so hard. But the way she paints with her words is just... it's something else, and it's incredibly special. So even though she's singing about things that may be in a different time, in a different place, there's still things that I can relate to, and I think that's really gorgeous about a great songwriter and lyricist.
Love came to my door with a sleeping roll and a madman's soul. He thought for sure I'd seen him dancing up a river in the dark, looking for a woman to court and spark. He was playing on the sidewalk for passing change when something strange happened. Glory train passed through him, so he buried the coins he made in People's Park and went looking for a woman to call. Spark. It seemed like he read my mind. He saw me mistrusting him and still acting kind. He saw how I worried. Sometimes I worry sometimes. All the guilty people, he said, they've all seen the stain on their daily bread, on their Christian names. I cleared myself, I sacrificed my blues, and you could complete me, I'd complete you. His eyes were the color of the sand in the sea, and the more he talked to me, you know, the more he reached me. But I couldn't let go of L.A., city of the fallen angels.
I haven't heard it put like that, but you're right, her... Her melodies and her voice and her phrasing and the chords are all so interwoven. They're completely inseparable. Like, yeah, it's like a whole, you know.
Yeah.
She's not bad. I would like to ask you about your Ivor Novello, because I was there. I saw you accept your Ivor Novello, the most prestigious of music awards. It's a biggie. How does that feel? Because it is, I mean, it's an oft-worn phrase, the most prestigious of all music awards, but the Ivor Novello really is that. It really is. It's got a special, you're just smiling. It's got a special kind of history and aura and almost responsibility connected to it.
Yeah, I mean, like thinking about it makes me go, oh my God, that was so good. I think I'd been to the Ivors maybe 8 years before.
Yeah.
And I'd always sat there in awe of everything that went on in that room because of the way people talked and who was there and the inspiration and the speeches and the performances. And it all just felt like it was... And it still obviously does feel like it's all songwriters and writers supporting each other. And it feels like one of the best that you could get because it's not voted by the public. It's seen as an art form. And I certainly wasn't expecting it because even on the day, because they played all the tracks.
All the little clips before the announcement, right, yeah.
Mine was the TV show, The Midwich Cuckoos. And... my clip, whatever they'd chosen, was just a drone. I remember watching it and going, oh my God, I so have not won this. Who's ever going to vote for a drone? And then when they announced it, I was like, oh my God, that's insane. So yeah, it was just an incredible feeling.
In April, I open my bill.
Those awards do mean something. They do allow you to get more work. They do allow you to have bigger budgets and to get more prestigious jobs. And they're really important for that. Like, there's no doubt in it. By saying you've got an Ivor changes a lot of things, especially in the film and TV world. I still think, you know, I think it's about 5 or 6% are female composers in that whole industry. And it is still a struggle. It's still a battle that you still got to prove yourself. You still got to do it. No matter how many awards and things that I've got now, I'm still having to gain trust from people a lot. And that's just part of the job, I guess, at this era.
I know that there's a lot of consternation around music and AI at the moment. I know it's especially happening in people that make library music and people that do music for adverts and stuff. Is it something that you and your contemporaries, I'm sure it's something you've discussed a lot. How concerned are you about whether legislation is going to protect creatives? Because especially in this world where it feels like that kind of music can be made easily and some people regard it as being more disposable because it's not Olivier Rodrigo single, it's more, it's serving a different kind of purpose. How do you feel about that? Because it's happening.
It's happening. It's happening across the board. Yeah, the library music is generating AI. I mean, even when you listen to Spotify and it goes off on its own, you know what the AI tracks are. I'm not worried, but I am concerned that we're not getting credited properly, especially when it's been copying our styles. And if you've got a unique style, I'm not worried because I know that I'll keep coming up with things that are different, that nobody else can do that anyway. So why would an AI be able to do it, a machine? But I'm not adverse to using tools to help. So, you know, like some of the sound tools that are being made for, like Logic and different audio interfaces, are using AI to help generate samples and do things. And those are not like machine learning, they're just like tools. And I am for them because they do help and they are brilliant. They save time by bouncing out a load of things and things like that. But it's still coming from me and it's still being led by me. So, but yes, there is a lot of conversations about making sure that the copyright is there and that we are getting credited properly and not being taken for a ride, which sadly is happening a lot.
It's not like musicians have it hard enough already, is it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I know. It's insane.
Let's talk about the unfolding. I mean, we're talking about first, I was told it's your first number one. It's a UK classical number one album. Tell me about the initial ideas behind that and working with the Power Orchestra and kind of how it came about.
First of all, the Power Orchestra are insanely incredible. They're a professional and disabled orchestra, so there is a mix of people in the group, but on their books, I mean, they had maybe 100 different artists, and I say artists because each of them is very individual to how they work and how they sound, and it was very hard for me to choose out of that massive pool of people what kind of thing I wanted to do and make with them. But when I started to research the instrumentation and what really resonated with me, because I did want it to have synthesizers and I wanted to work with instruments that would work well with that, it ended up being quite based around the lower woodwind section, including like a recorder. And there was a guy that played the contrabass recorder and all sorts of sizes of recorder, and he's blind as well. So learning the skills to be able to write for different people. So we did like research and development a couple of days, and I worked with the different artists and made sure that I know who I'm writing for, what they sound like, how are they going to work on the record, and then went away for probably a year or two, and maybe a bit longer because Furwave was in between that.
Wow, it took that long.
Yeah, and it wasn't until like lockdown that I had the time and space to go, right, I'm going to do this. And so it was really the whole concept behind that record was just looking at the human body, how we're not different, how we've developed from seeds in the earth and mud and where we have come from, and that cycle of like life and death, I guess. And yeah, it feels like a while ago, so I haven't spoken about it for a while. But
what did you learn from the experience?
Sometimes when you're doing things, you can't control stuff. So there is a certain element of allowing whatever is happening in the room to happen and to change things. So even though I've written this piece, I know exactly what's happening, I've scored it. When you get in a room, it sounds different. And that is through no fault of anybody's. That is just the fact that the instruments are not doing what you think in your head. And so you have to adapt and change and be open to that and free. You know, the drummer in the band, Johnny, what pieces of kit did he play? And I just didn't know that kind of thing. So there was like a lot of like adapting and changing and being able to cut things when they weren't working or embrace things that were working and add them in. So there was a lot of shifting and this kind of like being on a plateau with everybody together rather than it just being my album. It was theirs. It really was. It wasn't just my ego there. It was like, let's look at how this record can shape with you all in the room together.
Thank you.
what's happening right now? What you're doing at the moment? That you can talk about.
Yes, I know. There's a couple of film soundtracks that are coming out. But the main thing is I'm working on a record that will be out in early summer with the percussionist Bebe Wang. And it will be a full album, not a soundtrack. And I'm really proud of it. We've been doing it for 2 years. And it came from just doing a live show together, completely improvised. And we just decided to bring everything on stage. So I brought all different synthesizers and she brought all her percussion, like marimba, rice bowls, gongs, different types of drums, big Chinese drums. I mean, like everything. And we didn't know each other. We'd not really had conversations. We just turned up and we were like, let's see what comes out. And this one of these amazing gigs happened. And actually, Paul Weller was at it. And he was like, what the hell was that? The essence of the things we made from that and the other shows that we did, then we were like, let's try and make an album. And so we've made one. And I think it's probably one of the best things I've ever done. Yeah.
I love that idea of like not having a conversation, then just going to start to create something and not letting anything get in the way of what's just about to happen without... No preconceptions.
Yeah, when does that happen?
Yeah.
You know, you bring your influences of who you are. And I guess like our communication has always been through music. Bebe's English is incredible, but we still communicate better, I think, through the art rather than conversation. And so that record is full of play and mischief and fun and just rhythm after rhythm after rhythm. And it's like it feels like quite paganistic almost. So... that's what came out and that's where we've gone.
And the last question is, what's the last thing that we should play? What song should we end the show on?
Oh, I know what it should be. It's Cocteau Twins and Harold Budd playing Sea Swallow Me.
Then that's the track we'll go out on. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Cocteau Twins and Harold Budd with See, Swallow Me, the final choice of my guest on the first time today, Hannah Peel. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Imogene Thackeray. And of course, if you go to BBC Sounds, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this series, including my chat with Peaches, and shows from the archive, including conversations with Janelle Monáe, Tom York and Florence Welsh. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.